Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, the essential podcast for middle market business owners, key stakeholders, and the advisors who guide them. I'm Josh Pottinger and joined by my co-host, Jason Chirogiannis. Together, we lead ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team at UBS here in Austin, Texas. Now, over the course of almost 30 years, we've built a vibrant community and have curated a suite of resources tailored for your success, from insightful white papers and cutting-edge research to exclusive in-person events and expert-led podcasts. We are here to provide the tools that you need. Now, if you're considering an exit, this is likely the most significant financial decision of your life, and typically, you only have one chance to get it right. So our mission is clear: to arm you with the knowledge to enhance the value of your business, navigate a successful sale, and of course, optimize your post-exit financial outcomes. Now with that, let's dive in and unlock the strategies that will prepare you for a prosperous future. Hello everyone, it's Josh Pottinger here. I'm excited to announce Lightning in a Bottle episode number 32. And the topic we're going to be discussing today is Family Office 3.0. And I've got my good friend and colleague here, Mark Tepsik, on the line. Mark, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, Josh, thanks for having me again. Good to see you.
Good. Are you in the city?
I am here in the city in Midtown Manhattan.
All right, got to love technology here. So we can go anywhere in the world. So welcome back, everyone, to Lightning in a Bottle. In today's episode, we're going to take a deep dive into the evolving landscape of family offices, where they've been, where they're headed, and what it means for families navigating new wealth complexity. So, as I mentioned, joining us today is Mark Tepsik, and he's basically the BMOC, big man on campus, around family office design and governance strategy here at UBS, and is one of the co-authors behind our family office quarterly reports, which I'll go into in a sec here. But if his name sounds familiar, it's because Mark was our guest on episode 17, and that episode quickly became one of the most listened to in our series. And so Mark brings unique perspective from the front lines of this evolution because he's helping these families build infrastructure, making smarter decisions about outsourcing, and really thinking holistically about running their family enterprise like a real business. And so we're exploring the concept of Family Office 3.0 today, which is the convergence of institutional grade tools and talent with the entrepreneurial energy of newly capitalized families, and really what that means for the future of wealth stewardship. So I do want to give the audience a little heads up. We just launched our latest UBS Family Office Quarterly, and it's a big one. It's 52 pages. So we're not going to go through all of it, but the piece looks at some of the key areas most affected by President Trump's policies out of the gate. So we want to cut through the noise and assess really the true impacts on growth and inflation, as well as underlying themes like AI and electrification. We talk in the report about the sports investment market, which is really widely regarded as recognized as one of the most attractive investment opportunities today. We talk a little bit in the report about on the operational port front, which is effectively providing a roadmap for family meetings. We talk about the human capital section. So there's strong demand out there for experienced family office leaders. So for those of you that are listening to this, there's a lot of families looking for you. So got some good stuff here. And then we also talk a little bit about private aviation industry. So, but this conversation today, folks, we're going to, before we kind of dive in, Mark and I thought it would be a good idea to take a step back and look at how we got here. And so with that, Mark, you're here to discuss what you've coined as a Family Office 3.0. But before we look forward, can you just walk the audience through the evolution of how we've gone from 1.0 to 3.0, especially for those that have built and sold a business, since that's a lot of the folks we talk to. So,
yeah, of course. Thank you, Josh. So, before we get into 1.0, let's talk about where we've been and actually a little bit about why that matters to families and family offices, mm-hmm. right? So when I started in the family office industry, it was 2008, pre-financial crisis. Family offices were around. You didn't hear that much about them. And so you sort of felt, and still to an extent, felt like you were on an island, right? Like, you know, you're 10, 15 people spread out across investment, tax, accounting, philanthropy, admin, what have you. And you're just trying essentially to give great service, great advice, and operate a family's wealth like a business, right? And so 1.0, you felt sort of like an early explorer into the space, right? There wasn't a lot of maps out there. There wasn't a lot of tools. It was sort of you were engaging with tools that were really built for the institutional side or the retail wealth management side first, and then trying to essentially cobble all that together into the family office construct, which is, you know, you're dealing with families that have usually massive complexity. And so 1.0, right, is, hey, we're early explorers. There's not a lot of great maps drawn. There's not a lot of people that have been here before us, but the family office industry was there, right? Enter the global financial crisis, interest rates dropped to, let's just call it zero. Because of that, on some level, the rise of private equity, right? So you had private equity coming in, buying out family businesses, whereas historically a family business, you know, was passed on to the next generation. Maybe they were bought out by a strategic, or, you know, if they're lucky enough, they went public. But oftentimes going public, right, you had to be the right size with the right growth metrics, things like that, or, you know, strategic buyer for whatever number of reasons, sometimes that didn't happen. So now all of a sudden you had PE coming in, buying up and snapping up family businesses. So what happens when you lose that wealth infrastructure because the wealth was managed like a business? Now all of a sudden you're sitting on a bunch of cash and it's like, what do we do with this? Well, you need an infrastructure to replace that family business. So enter the family office. So you had the growth of the family office space, right? Number of family offices. So now all of a sudden, you know, the industry, which I'll just term banks, wealth management firms, accounting, law firms, and really technology solutions are saying, okay, how do we capture this opportunity, help these family offices out, right? So now all of a sudden you've got these resources, this infrastructure, both on the service side, both for technology being built for family offices, not for the retail wealth management channel or the institutional hedge fund private equity channel first, right? And so now you started to see the growth, the industry takes notice, okay? But now we're starting to enter 3.0, okay? And what is 3.0 and why does it matter? 3.0, and these lines are blurred, right, on sort of like the errors of the family office, right? So 2.0, 3.0. But 3.0 is, hey, we just don't have the ADIPARS, which is built for specifically family offices because their complexity, distributed balance sheet. We actually have firms and service firms that will do that for you, right? So think iCapital, Mirador. There is a great solution called TOS Advisors. It is really sort of like a don't touch it tech model, tech stack for family offices. So you're seeing this like optionality, flexibility, sort of the lines are being blurred of, okay, we don't have to vertically integrate everything anymore as a family office. So yeah, we've got purpose-built tools, but now it's like, okay, we could actually reduce headcount, become more efficient, you know, edge into the scale of these external firms, get pricing power. And so you're seeing firms that are being set up to operate out of par, right? And at the family office level itself, still kind of retain that brain of coordination, understanding the family's complexity and their balance sheet, as well as kind of the unique personalities in the family office, as well as the family. So that's kind of a different thing, right? That reduces the barrier to entry, in my opinion, to family offices.
Sorry to interrupt, but yeah. ADIPAR, I mean, yeah. I know what it is, but for those in the audience that may not be familiar with that.
Yep. So, you know, if you look at a family's assets, right, you've got, they often have multiple homes. They may have an art collection. They probably have lots of private assets that aren't coming through a custodian. So think real estate deals, direct investments in the startup on the cap table. You know, think portfolios at UBS, portfolios at other institutions, other banks. And so what does that leave you with? That leaves you with all this information in a bunch of different places. So ADIPAR was really, you know, built to say, hey, let me get a single picture and bring it all together and get that information. And so you get, you know, sort of live updates. And so before you saw a lot of family offices, and I still see a lot of family offices operating on Excel. And I say, listen, if it works for you, it works for you. But at some point, there'll be an inflection where you say, we need a better way, right? So you don't just have ADIPAR, which again, was built for the family office landscape and that complexity, but you have firms that are operating ADIPAR for you, okay? So I'll stick on that for a second, that dynamic. So I was part of a family office that operated, was an early adopter of ADIPAR. Like 2012, 2013, we're like, we need this. This is great. we onboarded, implemented it, and now what we did not anticipate was, so what do you actually need to operate at a part inside the family office, right? So a junior investment analyst at the time was repositioned, and all of a sudden he's doing this 20% of his time instead of doing due diligence and monitoring on our investments. So Mirador, you know, purchased by iCapital, solved for that solution, which is, hey, you get a permanent solution. Somebody at the family office doesn't need to do this. And so you're seeing flexibility and options like that. So it's just leaving families with a lot of options to tap into, which is, right, you know, has other challenges, right? It's like, okay, where do I find and how do I select these options?
By the way, the co-founder of Idapar is here in Austin, Texas.
Yeah. You know, I think from my knowledge, it spun out of a family office. So he was an early mover, right? Yep. Early mover in that space. And I happen to think it's, you know, a great tool and sort of best of breed, but there's a ton of innovation going on right now, especially with AI in this space. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here.
Yeah, I think the marriage of the iCapital Mirador solution with the Idapar is fantastic. Because like you said, you know, having somebody internally just spending all that time managing this beast of a software deal, when you can have a group that has basically a black belt in that can take care of that for you, is a great way to create efficiencies in the office.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you don't have access to that information at your fingertips, or if it's not easy to get, right, if you think of yourself like a business, if you want to manage your wealth like a business, and you don't have that, how are you making decisions if you don't have that clarity across your balance sheet?
Right. Thanks for that. Kind of walking through Family Office 1.0, which was pre-global financial crisis, then after the GFC, we had the rise of PE. Zero interest rates just created a flood of M&A activity and a flood of liquidity event, and created a lot of very wealthy families. And then they're just trying to figure out how to piecemeal and put things together. And now it feels like now there's tools and solutions that create a lot more efficiencies for them. And I can only imagine it's only going to get even better with artificial intelligence. So you're going to be able to do a lot more with a lot less overhead potentially.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, you know, if you're kind of like comparing the eras, right? Like I said, 1.0 is like early explorers, maps weren't there. Now all of a sudden you could tap into people that have the maps, right? That have been there before, as well as tap into these resources and infrastructure, which again, really there before. And if you want to compare, right, it's like, okay, let's look at computers, right? So you had the hardware come out first, and then all of a sudden, you know, you had Microsoft with their suite of services, and now you can have a phone in your pocket with a million different apps, right? So it just has led to innovation and has led to flexibility and optionality for families that have complexity, that really want to manage it like a business. So it just leads to better outcomes, which is helping the family make decisions better.
I'm so grateful to have the Family Office Solutions team to be a resource for us in the field, you know, as we talk to family offices, because I mean, this is what you're doing day in and day out, and you're seeing real time sort of the organic evolution of how these family offices are evolving, which gives new family offices or people that just haven't really created that structure provides so much value in terms of helping them not stub their toe as much and kind of making mistakes along the way, so they can kind of ramp up and get up to speed a lot quicker.
Yeah, no, it you know, like I said, it you know, if you look at a typical fact pattern, it's, hey, we sold our business. Who do we trust? It's the CFO that we dealt with that's down the hall for the past 15 years, right? So they go and hire that person. And that person, it's, you know, trust is obviously a key component. They've got the accounting knowledge, but they're really in a different industry,
right?
So it's, now you're in sort of like the wealth management industry, but it's not even just wealth management. It is everything that a family has going on. And so we're oftentimes working with that first hire to say, hey, here's the accounting infrastructure you should be looking at. Here's the consolidated reporting platforms, as well as the different options. Here's what the services should really look like, right? Like accounting, because oftentimes you're dealing with somebody that's, you know, just kind of operated QuickBooks or some other sort of more business centric or focused accounting infrastructure. And again, so we're just helping them kind of understand the lay of the land and the landscape and the do's and don'ts. And like you said, it just helps them ramp up quicker, make less mistakes. And again, it should lead to better outcomes over time for that office and the family.
So we kind of hit on this, but you know, you've described Family Office 3.0 as an era of abundance in terms of resources and support. But Why does that abundance matter so much right now?
So it matters because, you know, before, like I said, I mean, a family was just, you know, they sold out of a business where, you know, theoretically they knew everything, right? They were experts because they became successful, created a lot of wealth for themselves. And now all of a sudden they're in a different industry, right? Again, it could be wealth management. And they're saying, what don't I know? Okay. And so you've got sort of, hey, here's what you should be thinking about across your portfolio, your assets, your estate planning. Here's the infrastructure you need to build, right? So there's those maps. And then with all these options, right, you could create a purpose-built infrastructure to give you that clarity across all your complexity. And so the cost is coming down on what it takes to staff, operate, and run a family office. Now, I will say human capital itself is probably not getting cheaper because you actually have higher demand for those folks that really understand what they're doing in this space. But you're getting more of those people all the time just because of the number of family offices. And you're also getting options, solutions, and tech resources. So I'll give you a great example. So when I was at the family office, I was general counsel for a number of years. And again, I'm dealing with income tax issues, wealth transfer, estate planning, real estate development. You know, family went through a liquidity event, and there's just a million different issues. And so it's like, okay, great. I have access to outside counsel, but that outside counsel is costing me $800 an hour every time I pick up the phone. But, you know, if you think about our advanced planning resources here, and I love advanced planning, you could call them, right? If you're a client and say, hey, I'm going through a liquidity event. How do I position this to mitigate taxes? So they're going to review everything, offer up suggestions, and then that allows you to have, you know, to go through that brainstorming exercise off the clock, right? So you tend to be more open, more holistic, rather than, okay, we've got our corporate attorney M&A for the business, but oftentimes families don't know that they should have a, you know, separate counsel, wealth transfer, estate planning, as well as federal income tax for themselves and their ownership. They're kind of two separate kind of domains there, both the business and the personal, but advanced planning can help you navigate that, right? So if I would have known that, I could have called somebody like Brian Hans here, right? And tapped into that know-how off the clock. And again, it just leads to better outcomes. But like, have those services always sort of existed? I would say to an extent, but I would say the robustness of them, of these firms. So you probably always had that wealth transfer estate planning. Now you've got federal income tax. That's being looped in with philanthropy, right? Because a big piece of the liquidity event is oftentimes a donation, pre-sale planning to some philanthropic entity or vehicle. That's just an example, right? So that's sort of an example of, you know, a little bit of our offering. Whereas before, you know, you kind of had to navigate it all yourself and figure it out. It's going to cost you money and time. And so that's why I'm saying these resources and these infrastructures have really been built up for families.
So what about like families that fall below that $500 million mark, but still have real complexity? How can they run their wealth more like a business without building a full internal staff?
Yeah, exactly. They need infrastructure, right? So if you think about a business, they've got an accounting back office, you know, treasury, they're doing inflows and outflows. You could say, hey, if I make this decision, do this acquisition of my business, how does this affect my cash flows, right? Just for instance, liquidity profile and everything in the total mix of the company. Families need something like that for their personal lives, right? So there's a host of resources just on the accounting side that you could tap into on an outsourced basis, right? So Anderson Personal Accounting Services, I think I mentioned in the latest quarterly, you've got firms like Trove, firms like Aquilance, Tenant Advisors, that you could leverage on an outsourced basis. So you don't have to go hire a CFO or a controller or a bookkeeper to do this for you. You could tap into this, right, as a permanent solution. So that is just one example. And it just allows you to build that infrastructure in a easier and quicker way. And you're tapping into firms that have been around for decades, right? So you could go hire your own bookkeeper, but do you know what you don't know as a family in what that bookkeeper should and should be doing? And also there's risk there. And so you're engaging with firms that are bonded, they're insured, they've been doing this for a while, so they know what to look out for, right? So you're also tapping into that sort of like accumulated knowledge that they build up over time.
So when we were walking through the evolution of family offices, you mentioned kind of in the 2.0 era that a lot of family offices are formed after a private equity exit, and that these families are really starting to play offense as investors. So can you talk about how that's changing the investment landscape?
Yeah, this is something that I think is very early innings at this point. I mean, yeah, you've got the family offices that are, you know, in the newspaper all the time or on Bloomberg that, you know, they're throwing around billions of dollars, right? They're massive. That's not really what I'm talking about here. And what you're alluding to is, you're exactly right. So a lot of these families and family offices were formed, post PE event. And so, you know, with the velocity of private capital out there, a lot of these people that are going through liquidity events, monetizing their businesses, are younger than you've seen people monetizing their business in the past, right? So you're 40 and 50, and you're a builder, and you're a creator and business operator and founder in your DNA. And so a lot of times these guys and girls don't want to sit back and ride off into the sunset. They want to be active. And so historically it's like, yeah, direct investments, I'm going to throw some money at direct investments, but there's a couple challenges with that. So let's look at a family with $500 million, which is still a lot of money. And you want to go into this, and let's say there's eight or nine family members, right? That kind of that $500 million is split between. And you want to play in the direct investment space. Well, after you deploy your capital, right? So say you have an IPS and you've got allocations, you're sort of out of dry powder, okay? And so what do? You kind of have to sit there until you get some other liquidity event back and then sort of redeploy and reposition that capital. And so I've started to see families and family offices and these builders and creators say, like, listen, I still want to like be very active and like use my decades of experience in this specific industry and building and creating, but I don't necessarily want to be in that CEO founder seat. So I'm starting to see families come to the realization, like, yeah, the direct investment is fun, but I have significant challenges with that because it's not really a business and I'm more passive. And so they're saying, okay, I'm going to form a fund, raise some third-party capital with a couple like-minded people. I'm not talking 100 LPs. And we're going to go deploy into the industry that we may have just left because I know everybody. I know the industry still. And so I'm going to leverage my know-how. And, you know, the founders like that of the portfolio of the companies they're investing in because they're engaging with somebody who's had to make payroll, who's done it before, who's coming with a reputation. And it tends to be a longer hold time, right? So typical PE GP is like, hey, 3 to 5 year hold time. We're going to flip it, raise another fund. These families are like, hey, we don't have a defined hold time. We're going to build, we can invest for the long term, not just only if we're going to get a payback within 3 or 4 years. So what does that mean for these family offices? What does it mean for those portfolio companies? And what does it mean for investors? Okay. So family offices, again, just to use the $500 million hypothetical example, they're in a race for talent. So it's very challenging to pluck somebody from PE land when they're getting a piece of the carry. There's a track ahead of them, right? Like institutional capital. And they're, you know, family offices are trying to get these folks and they're saying, well, why would I leave if I'm going to come to this family office that is like, hey, we're going to do deals if we can't scale up this capital, right? So it's helping you to scale these ambitions as a family office, pay for people. As a portfolio company, you get somebody that's been in your shoes, has the industry knowledge, has the connections, and that you can kind of leverage for the capital. Now, instead of a 3 to 4 to 5 year hold time, you're getting a longer hold time, theoretically, not all the time. So it's kind of like, okay, if you're a quarterback, do you want a new coach and a new system with new potentially new players around you every 3 to 4 years? Or do you want that same coach with the same system? So it allows you to keep your eye on the business rather than getting a new coach with a new system every couple of years who has different KPIs, different personalities, way of doing things. That's one thing. The other is for an investor, if you're taking that same pool of capital and getting a tax hit every 3 to 4 years, you're going to have seepage, right? And leakage from a tax event, you know, capital gains. And so instead of just paying taxes every 3 to 4 years, that's going to compound over, you know, 10 to 15. So I tend to think it's kind of a unique sort of aspect of private equity, right? And private equity is evolving all the time. So I'm not here to say, well, all private equity is looking to monetize in 3 to 5 years. You're seeing a lot of diversification, innovation in the space. But I think families bring a lot to the table just as builders and operators, as their DNA. They've done it before, and they often have a longer hold time. So I see the space evolving. The other reason, just to take a step back again and revisit this, is you'll hear about families saying, hey, there's four or five of us, let's come together and like share deals every now and then. The issue with that is, I've seen it a million times, is the deals are all over the place. It's like, we've got a car dealership, we've got this real estate deal, we've got this vet roll-up. They're all different. And any of these family offices that have agreed to kind of come together and communicate can say, I'm out, for a million different reasons. But with the fund, you're saying, hey, this is what we're going to target, this industry, this size portfolio company. Here's kind of the hold times. You're either in or out. So you don't have this highly inefficient process of like,
yeah.
Doing the round robin thing every time.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. I mean,
yeah,
especially for the poor souls that are running the family offices for the families.
You know, I've got a couple like entrepreneurs that I've been talking to, within the past couple months, that they've historically shied away from looking at this fund. They're somewhat aware of it, but because they're saying like, I don't need to do this. But because they're saying like, I don't really want the responsibility of investors. But a lot of times their employees at the family office are saying like, no, we could do this. You don't have to like manage these investors, right? We can have an IR person. Like, you could be sort of, I'll just call it like more chairman level rather than like, you know, kind of operations day-to-day level. And so I'm seeing it from like some of their employees coming in and say like, we've got this platform here. Why don't you offer it up to other investors that, you know, again, we don't need 100 LPs, a couple like-minded families that share kind of the same philosophy on doing things. So I just think it's, the time is right. Plus, if you just look back at like 1.0, there was no MAPS. If you want to compare that to this era, private equity has been around, right? So it's not like a new asset class you're creating. You basically just have longer hold times and probably a different philosophy. And so you could also go and pluck from PE, but you need to be able to pay these people, right? Because they're giving up something at that PE firm that they've been at. They're giving up potential partnership. So you need to be able to pay them. So there's a bunch of different reasons why families should definitely explore this if they want to do it. I'm not saying like you should do it just because it's an opportunity. You need to be able to want to do it.
What you're saying is spot on with some of my observations over the past, I guess, few years. One conversation that I had with a gentleman, I mean, they had effectively created a little mini Berkshire Hathaway, so to speak, right? So they invest in all these like operating companies. The one question I had for him was like, okay, so how did those founders monetize that business?
Yeah.
You know, you're saying that these are much longer hold times. Like, already we're seeing an extension in the life cycle of building a private company and eventually having some sort of liquidity event. You know, companies used to go public in 4 or 5 years. Now it's more like 10, 11, 12 years. And we've got these interest rate cycles and, you know, zero interest rates. I mean, that makes everything easy. But when you're in a more normalized environment, not as easy. You have a ton of liquidity out there. And so I'm kind of going off topic a little bit, but you just kind of struck a thought here. How are these family offices, I guess, managing that part, right?
Yeah, there's a couple considerations there, and it's come up. One is, okay, well, I'm leaving this PEGP, right, as whatever, a mid-level person. And I'm having events seemingly every year because, you know, they probably got a couple funds raised. And so how am I getting paid, right? Like, yeah, this is a different, there's greater opportunity maybe for me, but like, how am I getting paid? Like, what's the off ramp, right? And so we're starting to explore that, like what it means for compensation, and as well as for both the internal family office staff, but also for that founder. You know, there's a couple different ways to do it. It's, I think, you know, the secondary funds is going to play a larger role in some of this. And so I think you're going to see secondary funds not coming in to take out the whole thing, but providing liquidity actually to some employees as well as some of these founders using the Berkshire model that you had mentioned. It's sort of like a holding company, right? So I've heard, and I haven't seen this yet, but I've heard there's one model where, okay, well, we're going to strike and have an evaluation at, you know, every January when you're going to get 60 days and we're going to have like sort of like a redemption pool. And if you want it, we'll buy you out. And there's some ways, right, to provide liquidity that way. So it's like a long-term vehicle. You're getting liquidity. So there's a couple, yeah, you're right. There's a couple different challenges. And, you know, you're also dealing with, I mean, if you're going into the typical PE, you know, 3 to 5 year whole time, you know, you're going to get your capital back in theory, right? Even though these last couple of years have been challenged. But you're hopefully, that's what I'm saying, it's a couple LPs, a couple families that have sort of that like-minded that they're not going to need this liquidity, right? They're going to allow it to compound. And I think if you look at sort of typical PE allocations, right, 20 to 30%, or I should say all allocations, 20 to 30%, is it going to be 20 to 30% that's in this strategy long-term? No. But is there a space on people's balance sheets for this long-term hold? I think so. So I think it's going to definitely develop over time on what these comp structures and then kind of like liquidity mechanisms look like. But I also think secondary funds can play a big role here too in providing liquidity.
Yeah, I agree with you. One of the challenges in the secondary market though is the size limit. You know, there's got to be enough size there for these secondary funds to really step in, right?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I think that space is going to develop, especially as there's more need here, you know, just from dealing with the institutional kind of challenges that have arisen from more institutional like PE. You know, there's one here locally in New York that, you know, they were like a $90-100 million secondary fund. I think they're on like their second one. And so they've actually been pretty nimble and flexible on looking at these smaller sized kind of opportunities, you know, because still that you're going to need diversification within that 90 to 100. So it's not like you're going to bite off, you know, 2 to 3 positions.
Right.
You know, they're have like 10 or a dozen at least. So, you know, there's still obviously some unanswered questions that needed to kind of develop, but I'm starting to see this percolate in the minds of some entrepreneurs because they don't want to just sit back and like direct invest, but like more from an allocation standpoint and like being more passive. Like they want to be a little more hands-on because they got a lot of runway ahead of them. That's what they like to do is build and create. So I've been seeing it a little bit.
Yeah, so many different nuances. I mean, even if you get somebody that's in their, you say, mid-40s, mid-50s or something like that, you know, they still have a fair amount of gas in the tank, but at some point they'll need some sort of transition program because if they're building this very long-term 20-year kind of vehicle or whatever, I mean, at some point they're going to be like, okay, I need to take more of a chairman's role
on
this deal.
Of course.
So some other conversations I've had before too, which syncs up exactly what you're saying, which is these serial entrepreneurs that have been doing this for a long time, and they sort of got their go-to investors that have been investing alongside of them, and they've been doing onesies and twosies for so long. They're like, you know what? Why don't we just wrap this up? Let's just set up a fund, like you said. Like, let's become the GP, and we're just going to have like a dozen LPs that all kind of know the game. They've been with us for a long time. It just creates a little bit more structure and professionalism to the whole program. So yeah, I'm hearing exactly what you're saying in the field. So
yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens because I mean, there's going to be a lot of innovation in the space because people are so younger. I mean, a couple of years ago, I had a client, you know, he sold his business. He had only started it probably 4 to 5 years prior for $500 million. He did have some investors, so he wasn't netting all 500, but he's like, I'm done. I'm riding off into the sunset. He still had some role equity, but he took himself out of the CEO role. You know, he's going to have a second bite of the apple coming down the line. So, you know, rides off into the sunset and he calls me like 2 or 3 months later. He's like, I just closed on like a 15-acre parcel down here in Florida. I'm going to throw a bunch of townhomes on it. So sometimes these, again, this is just who they are by DNA, right?
Yeah.
So again, they just don't want to sit there and be passive. They seek out opportunity, they spot it, they want to capitalize on it. And so this is just another way to do it.
Something that we've seen a lot too is when one has a large liquidity event, they get very excited about having all this liquidity. And usually it hits the news reels, right? So everybody knows they've got a lot of liquidity. And so they get a ton of deal flow and they start making investments in all these illiquid businesses that sound phenomenal, you know, sounds fantastic. But then over the course of 3, 4, 5 years, they've over allocated to a very illiquid space and a dozen, 15, you know, different deals. And so managing liquidity is so key. You know, I know that's something that was talked about in this latest Family Office Quarterly, which is how family offices are dealing with cash. You've got multi-generational family offices or just one generation, whatever it might be, but managing cash and liquidity and being mindful of how much you're allocating to the illiquid assets. If you're not careful, it comes back to bite you.
Oh, 100%. And I agree with you. I mean, a lot of times, you know, it's fun, right? So it's like, okay, I went through a liquidity event. I'm sitting on a mound of capital and I'm going to go, you're right. They get hit up any which way. And then they sit back after a couple of years and say, okay, what is this that I allocated to? Right. And, you know, I mean, if they're coming out of a liquidity event, they had been successful. So they sort of have that bias, like also going to pop. But you're right, they run into liquidity issues themselves. A couple of ways to get around that is, you know, coming up with an IPS and saying, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to acknowledge it. I'm going to continue to allocate to the direct space.
Yeah.
But I'm going to set sort of like a budget and a band for myself to say, all right, I have got $500 million. I'm only ever going to allocate no more than, just making up a number, you know, $100 million, right? So, and that's the issue, because once you allocate your $100 million, it's not like allocating to the stock market, right? You can't, you can't sell it. So once you're out of dry powder, that's where the real challenge comes on that side of your balance sheet or your portfolio. And that's why it's challenging for, you know, most family offices that aren't $50 billion in net worth to play in this direct investment PE space, because you're challenged from a family office staff perspective, you're challenged from your own capital perspective, and you're competing with PE funds that are raising a new fund. Seemingly, you know, they seemingly have an endless supply of capital funding on us because they're raising a new fund, you know, nearly constantly. So, so it's, those are the challenges. Yeah.
We see a lot of cases, a lot of these entrepreneurs, they are ADD, ADHD, they're shoot from the hip a lot of times. Creating an investment policy statement makes so much sense. And we've seen them do it, but then a month later, abandon it.
Yeah.
You know, so it takes some discipline. And frankly, I mean, that's how a lot of these folks created so much success, right? It's like not playing by these structured rules. And they were taking, maybe they were taking risks. They didn't even realize that they were taking, but it's like when you're too smart and too thoughtful about being too structured, you're not thinking outside the box. But again, it's just I tell people all the time, it's like our job, you know, there's a lot of science to the work that we do, but there is a huge amount of art to it, because behavioral finance, behavioral psychology, all that kind of good stuff comes into play.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree, because, you know, if you're dealing with an operator or a business owner, they're not seeing their net worth going down on a day-to-day basis, right? You log into Addepar and see that you're down.
Yeah.
And so it's, like I said, it's definitely a different industry. You go from owner-operator, right? You're selling stuff, to now all of a sudden, it's more psychology-based, and that's where the IPS comes in. Again, is it going to cure, like, you know, people aren't robots, so they're going to do what they want with their capital. But I like to say, like, go through that process with the IPS, and if you want to allocate, this helps you kind of think through your capital, right? Again, if you just want to say, okay, 10 to 20%, I'm only ever going to allocate to the direct investment space. We got a budget, you know, for every 50 deals that you come in, you know that you're going to have to be judicious and prudent with that piece of capital you're going to allocate. So it helps you at least sit back and say, okay, I could pass on these couple deals because I probably want to do this one or that one that I know is coming. You definitely need an IPS, but yes, you're right, at the end of the day, especially in families that aren't multi-G and it's chopped up a bunch of ways, because if it's just residing with one person, you know, they could be flexible and do what they want. But you get into issues because the markets go up and down, and people got a lot of personal assets like cars, or not cars. I mean, they got that, but really the residences. So at the end of the day, it's that capital and that wealth is fungible. So it depends on like what you're going to do with it and what that liquidity looks like.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I think we're wrapping up here at the end of our time. I try to keep these around 40, 45 minutes or so. So thank you so much for joining us and unpacking this concept of Family Office 3.0, it's clear that the space is no longer just for the ultra wealthy with in-house teams, but a growing and dynamic segment reshaping private capital and intergenerational wealth. And so for the listeners out there that are interested in learning more, check out the full UBS Family Office Quarterly. It's a great piece from Mark and crew. It's titled Family Office 3.0 in Action, which we've linked in the episode description. If you're a founder or a family office and you're thinking about how to take the next step in your journey, we're always, always happy to be a sounding board here and pulling in our fantastic resources like Mark and Brian, our advanced planning team, and our philanthropy and family advisory team. So we've got a lot of resources here. So just reach out to us. And with that, thanks, Mark, again. Wish you the best rest of the week and have a good weekend. Thanks for tuning in, everyone.
Thank you, Josh. It's always a pleasure.
Very good. We'll catch you on the next one. Everybody be healthy and take care. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning in to Lightning in a Bottle. It's been a pleasure bringing you today's insights from the brightest minds in business. To stay updated with relevant content, exclusive events, and our latest podcast episodes, send us a note to atxwealthpartners.com. Until next time, keep capturing the lightning of innovation and turning it into success. I'm Josh Pottinger, wishing you a productive and prosperous week ahead. And don't forget, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.